Now, Westwood One presents the Lost Linen Tapes, brought to you by Listerine and by Nestle's Alpine White, sweet dreams you can't resist. Here's our host, Elliot Mintz.
During the next hour, we're going to hear John and his boyhood pal Pete Shotten talk about life in Liverpool with John's Aunt Mimi. John and Pete will also recall the birth of the Quarrymen and the day they met Paul McCartney. We'll hear some rare tape of the Quarrymen along the way. Pete and John will help us to get to know John's fun-loving mother, Julia, and we'll hear another take in the evolution of John's demo for Strawberry Fields Forever. But before we head back to Men Love Avenue in the early 50s, let's listen to this unreleased song from one of John's work tapes. It's a tune he and Yoko were considering for a stage production they were planning, which carried the working title, The Ballad of John and Yoko. Here's take two of Whatever Happened To.
Other way around, Voisin. Two, three, four.
Got a job.
From one of his Dakota work tapes, John Lennon and Whatever Happened To, a previously unreleased tune slated for the proposed stage play, The Ballad of John and Yoko.
John and Pete Shotten recall their childhood in the Woolton area of Liverpool, with a little help from Aunt Mimi.
But here it is, in black and white, as plain as a pikestaff. This is a Lancashire family on both sides. We are Liverpudlians. Nothing on God's earth can alter that, and that is that. And if you're not English, and we are not English, then I'm a Dutchman.
Next on the Lost Lennon Tapes. Let's return to the Lost Lennon Tapes.
John Winston Lennon was born in Liverpool's Oxford Street Maternity Hospital at 6:30 p.m. on October 9, 1940. Legend has it that John's mother, Julia, delivered him during an air raid by Hitler's Luftwaffe. A great story, but not true. When John was barely 6 months old, Julia left him in the care of her older sister, Mary Elizabeth, nicknamed Mimi, and Mimi's husband, George, the local dairyman. John's father, Freddie, was off at sea working as a steward on troop ships crossing the Atlantic, and for the free-spirited Julia, taking care of an infant son alone was just too much to handle. Now, Mimi, George, and John lived in a comfortable neighborhood of Liverpool called Woolton at 251 Menlove Avenue. To get a better understanding of the neighborhood where John grew up, let's take a short tour of the area guided by John's best friend as a child, Pete Shotten.
One of the fallacies is that, like, John came from Liverpool, you know, poor area, Dockland boy, that type of thing, you know, really running around in rags, no food to eat, begging on the street corner. It's all complete nonsense. It's media stuff to kind that people like to hear. We were completely surrounded by fields and woods and parks and a golf course right over the road from us. We had so many places to play. It was unbelievable. And Strawberry Fields as such was... It's not the orphanage part which is the image now of Strawberry Fields. That was just like the big house that was up way out beyond the woods. But the woods actually came down to where my road was, which was Vale Road, which joined Menlove Avenue, which is where John lived, just on the corner. So at the junction, more or less, was where all the woods were. And we used to climb over the wall there to go into these woods to get these things called conkers, which were chestnuts. We used to put them on a string, and we used to, like, bash each other's conkers with these things. It's a game that's very popular in England amongst kids. But to get these conkers was... The best place to go was Strawberry Fields, so we always thought of the woods as Strawberry Fields, really.
Let me take you down. Forever. a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field. Nothing is real, nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever. Strawberry Fields forever.
But as far as the area that we went, it was a beautiful area, Walton. It was a lovely place. John had a lived in a lovely house. It was a nice four-bedroom, semi-detached house. He was well looked after. He had all the clothes he needed. He had the food he needed. He had a bed and a roof to go home to. And he had a couple of people, you know, his surrogate parents, Aunt Mimi and Uncle George, who were, for all intents and purposes, as good of parents as anybody else ever had.
In his 1980 interview for Playboy, John spoke fondly of his Aunt Mimi and Uncle George and his extended family.
This image of me being the orphan is garbage, because I was well protected by my auntie and my uncle, and they looked after me very well, thanks. So, and that's for her, my auntie, because she objects to a remark Paul made saying that I had probably was staying with Sean now because I'd never had a family life. It's absolute rubbish. Yeah. There were five women that were my family. Five strong, intelligent, beautiful women. Were five sisters. One happened to be my mother. My mother just couldn't deal with life. She was the youngest, and she had a husband who ran away to sea, and the war was on, and she couldn't cope with me, and I ended up living with her elder sister.
Julia said, all I did was have him. He was determined to be with you from he was born.
They were fantastic women, and they dominated the situation in all the family. The men were just invisible in our family. And I was always with the women. I always heard them talk about the men and talk about life, and they always knew what was going on. The men never, never, ever knew.
Miserable little shrimp with no backbone.
And that was my first feminist education.
Pete says the relationship between John and his Aunt Mimi was a special one, despite their frequent clashes.
As far as Mimi was concerned, she adored him, you know. But she was a disciplinarian, and she knew that he was full of mischief as well.
By Jove, if you start mucking about after this, I don't want to hear any more about it.
But she always tried, in a way, to blame the fact on me, as my parents tried to blame the fact on John, that I was always in trouble, right? So it was one of these things. And she was one of these people who, try as hard as she may to keep a stern face in a situation where she felt that she should exert her authority and discipline on John, he had this knack, not only with her but with everybody, but he could get right through to her completely. And the number of times that I saw her trying to shout at John, and he'd give her one of her grins, or his grins, or say just one of his words, or whatever it was, and you'd see her just crumble completely into laughter, and they'd both end up screaming, laughing together. And of course then she'd come around, she'd get mad at herself because of the fact that she hadn't carried out the duty that she felt was right to have done in that circumstance. But over the course of the years, Mimi and I got very close and very friendly. I liked Mimi a lot.
So, there you are. That's that.
Coming up on the Lost Lennon Tapes, John and Pete recall the birth of the Quarrymen and how Paul McCartney joined the group. Stay with us.
Now tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road.
Let's rejoin Lost Lennon Tapes host, Elliot Mintz.
In March 1957, with Lonnie Donegan, Elvis, and Chuck Berry burning in his ears, and armed with the guitar he'd conned Aunt Mimi into buying for £17, John formed his first group. The band specialized in skiffle, a form of folk music derived from American folk, blues, and jazz.
My original group was named after my school, which is Quarry Bank, which had the Latin logo, ex hoc metalla virtuta, meaning out of this rock. It's just symbolic, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You will find truth. And my first group was called the Quarrymen because we were all from the same school.
The first Quarrymen lineup included John and Eric Griffiths on guitar, Rod Davis on banjo, Bill Smith and or Len Gary on bass, Colin Hanton on drums, and Pete Shotton on washboard.
We used to play in my back garden. We had an old bomb shelter made out of tin, you know, that had still been left there. They used to throw the junk, and we cleared this out. We all used to crowd into this thing and play, me on the washboard and Len on the bass and John on his guitar and whatnot, and a guy called Eric Griffiths who'd got a guitar too. And we all used to get in there and jam away, thinking we were the greatest things on earth.
Well, Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Cumberland Gap, ain't nowhere 15 miles from Middlesbrough. Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap.
The band played their first gig on June 9th, 1957 at Liverpool's Empire Theatre. Less than a month later, on July 6th, John and the group met another young musician from the neighboring area of Allerton. His name was Paul McCartney. And he was there at the suggestion of sometime Quarrymen bassist Ivan Vaughn, also a mutual friend of John and Pete's. The occasion was a Quarrymen gig at the Woolton Parish Church.
The village used to have a fete once a year, and this used to consist of taking a pretty girl from the neighborhood and crowning her rose queen and having a sideshows and all this kind of thing. And my mother managed, because my mother was very clever at managing things like this, to organize it so that we were the entertainment. Now, first of all, we played in the back of the lorry in the field, which is the scouts field at the back of the church. And then in the evening, we went over to play for a dance that they were putting on. We were playing at that time mostly Lonnie Donegan stuff, you know. And as I say, we thought we were terrific, and a lot of people said that we were, especially our mothers and aunties. And Ivan had come along and brought this friend along, who he told us he was bringing along, who he said could play the guitar pretty well. So after we'd finished playing, we came down off the stage, and Ivan introduced this kid to us, and his name happened to be Paul McCartney, as we all know now.
Well, bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't mean my baby. Well, she's the gal in the red blue jeans. She's the queen of all the teens. She's the woman that I know. She's the woman that loves me so. Say, bebop Lula, she's my baby. Bebop Lula, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Lula, she, my baby.
In an interview almost 10 years afterward, Paul and John described their meeting like this.
I went with a friend of mine whose name was Ivan. He's a good friend of ours, you see, and I met him years ago. I was at school with Ive, and I went to a village fete with Ivan, and the group that was on the fete, one of them, or a few of them rather, were friends of Ivan's, and that was John and a couple of his mates, and they were in a little group then playing.
Rather a large group, Paul, was about 14
well,
of us.
Little in stature.
Little in name, I'd say, Paul, but rather gross.
Large by number, yes.
Large by number. We had banjos, things like that.
Washboards, skiffle boots, the whole lot.
And we spent about 20 minutes talking to him. At first, it was, like, very reserved, because John was always a bit, like, withdrawn or a bit careful about meeting new people. He used to like to suss them out. He'd never make the first move. People always had to come to him at first. And eventually, Paul, like, came to him by getting his guitar out. Paul, being the extrovert, broke the kind of awkwardness by getting his guitar out and playing, I think it was 20 Flight Rock.
Ooh, well, I gotta get over the record machine when it comes to rock, and she's the queen. We love to dance on a Saturday night. All alone where I can hold her tight, but she lives on the 20th floor of town. The elevator's broken down, so I walk 1, 5, 3, 5, 4, 5, 6, 7, flight 8, flight more. Up on the 12th, I'm starting to drag. 50 feet to 4, I'm already to sag. Get to the top, I'm too tired to rock.
And it was good, you know. And John was obviously impressed by this, so we had a bit of a chat for a while, and as I say, about 20 minutes later, we all split up, and John and I were walking home together, and John said to me, what do you think of him then, of Paul? And I said, I think he's okay, I like him. And he said, well, should we ask him to join the band then? And I said, yeah, it's okay by me if it's okay by him. And so that was that. We went home. Didn't see Paul again for a while, and I was just so happened I was the next person to see him. I'd come out of my house, he was riding past my house on his bike, he jumped off his bike just to start chatting. We chatted a bit past the time of day, and then it suddenly occurred to me that we had decided to have him in the band. Wow, lucky guy. And I said to him, oh, by the way, Paul, do you want to join the band? And he thought for a minute, very casually, and he said, okay then, and jumped on his bike and rode off.
More than a decade later, in December 1970, John explained why bringing McCartney into the band was a good move.
Was it better to have a guy who was better than the people I had in, obviously, or not? To make the group stronger or to let me be stronger? And that decision was to let Paul in to make the group stronger. And then from that, Paul introduced me to George, and Paul and I had to make the decision, well, I had to make the decision whether to let George in. And I listened to him play and said, play raunchy or whatever the old story is, and I let him in. I said, okay, you come in, and that was the three of us then, and then the rest of the group was thrown out gradually. And it just happened like that. So we, instead of going for an individual thing, we went for the strongest format, you know, and for equals.
And, you know, we've known each other quite a long time now.
I can vouch for that.
I bet you can, John.
By spring 1960, the Quarrymen had changed their name to the Silver Beatles, and Stu Sutcliffe, John's friend from art college, had joined John, Paul, and George as bass player. Now, the band taped some of their rehearsals on primitive home equipment, and here's how they sounded working on one of John's earliest compositions, the one after 909. Remember, out of modest beginnings comes greatness.
Thank you.
Coming up on the Lost Lennon Tapes, Strawberry Fields Forever, the next evolution. Now let's get back to the Lost Lennon Tapes.
Earlier in the show, we heard Pete Shotten describe the neighborhood where he and John grew up together, so it seems quite fitting that we break out this unreleased version of Strawberry Fields Forever, dating back to late 1966. From the Lennon Archives, here's John accompanying himself on electric guitar. John's personal tapes, an electric guitar version of Strawberry Fields Forever, a work in progress during the final weeks of 1966.
When we return to the Lost Lennon Tapes, John and Pete paint a loving character portrait of John's mother, Julia, and we'll hear John's demo for the song, Julia, from the Beatles' White Album.
And you can't deny it because every word in it is true.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Let's return to the Lost Lennon Tapes.
During his early teens, after living with his Aunt Mimi and Uncle George since infancy, John began to seek out the mother he barely knew, Julia. Soon after husband Freddie had gone to sea, Julia had begun living in a nearby neighborhood with her new man, a hotel waiter named John Dykens. Pete Shotten.
He initiated the move to start going and seeing his mum, basically from school, because what we used to do, we used to play truant from school, and this was like a safe house to go to, you know. I mean, John used to go down there first, and I'd say, where have you been to? You know, he'd say, I've been down to my mum's, you've got to come down, right? So one day he took me down to meet her, and she opened the door, and this was the first meeting I'd had with her, and the door opened, and there's this, like, slip of a woman in her, well, I don't know, early mid-30s or something, but looking very young. And she's got a pair of knickers on her head, apparently this is something that she used to do. She used to pick up anything that was handy if she was doing the dusting. She used to flit round the house with the feather duster and sing away and had record player and speakers in each room, which was a great thing for us in those days. But I went into the room, she welcomed us in, great to see you. She didn't care less about us, you know, playing truant. She wanted to, in fact, used to virtually encourage us to come again tomorrow if you can, lads, you know. And I went in, she said, and John said, this is Pete. I thought, oh, this is Pete. She said, oh, fantastic. And she came rushing over to me. And I thought she was just going to shake hands or say hello or something like that. Instead of that, she ran her hands up and down my hips and she said, oh, isn't he lovely? Hasn't he got lovely hips, you know? And I turned to John and said, hey, this is great. Right, she's terrific. You could see directly where John got his humour and his love of life from. She was always saying to us, look, don't worry about it, you know, it'll be okay, don't worry about tomorrow, just have a good time today, that's all that matters. It was her attitude about life, her philosophy about life, her fun and her love of laughing that did. I mean, she used to wear these spectacles with no glasses in, you know, and like people would come to the door to collect bills like the bread man or something, and she'd just talk to them and stick her finger through the frame and start rubbing her eye, and it just used to, people just look at her, they couldn't believe it, you know, she was just crazy. And that's where John got his humour from, without a doubt.
Now, John's favourite expression in those days was,
it'll turn out all right in the end. I used to say that to my friend Pete Shotton, who was in the Quarrymen before Paul was in it. And he used to worry about, you know, taking the GCE exam at grammar school. And I used to use that expression then, which is something will turn out. Because I always failed the exams, or never did any work, and he was always worried about his future. And I'd always say to him and the gang that was around me then, because I always had a gang that was always the leader of a little gang of guys, you know, the usual trip. And the Beatles just became my new gang. But I always had a group of three or four or five guys around with me who would play various roles in my life, supporting and, you know, subservient, but both roles being taken. But in general, me being the bully boy. And it was that I always believed that something would turn up, that it would be all right. So I didn't make plans for the future. I didn't pass the exam. I didn't put a little bit on the side. I didn't, you know, ever, I wasn't capable of doing it, therefore I was the one that all the other boys' parents, including Paul's father, would say, keep away from him, because they knew what I was. The parents instinctively recognized what I was, which was a troublemaker, meaning I did not conform and I would influence their children, which I did. I did my best to disrupt every friend's home that there was, partly maybe out of envy that I didn't have this so-called home, but I did. I had an auntie and an uncle and a nice suburban home, thank you very much. And the fact that I wasn't tied to parents, that was the difference, that I would infiltrate the other boys' minds into the parents are not gods, because I don't live with minor, therefore I know.
Now, John, what do you think that makes you?
Parents were terrified of me and my influence, simply because I was free from the parent stranglehold. That is the gift that people... That was the gift I got. That was the gift I got of not having parents. Mm-hmm. I've cried a lot about not having them and the torture it was, but also the gift of awareness is given of not being...
It didn't take some
people,
years.
Right, most people never get out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people cannot see that their parents are still torturing them even when they're in their 40s and 50s. They'll have that stranglehold over them and their thoughts and their mind and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the gift of being a so-called orphan, which I never was at all. My mother was alive and lived 15 minutes walk or away from me all my life. And I saw her sporadically off and on all the time. I just didn't live with her.
He discovered a relationship that he hadn't had before. It was a relationship that was very close because it had been developed, not from a childhood thing, but from a different level. And he was incredibly fond of his mother, very, very close to her.
What I say is meaningless, but I
just to reach you, Julia, Julia, ocean child, calls me, so I sing some love for
album pre-production sessions in late May 1968, John Lennon's demo for Julia, combining imagery relating to both his mother and to Yoko Ono. It's a song he wrote in India while meditating at the Maharishi's camp in Rishikesh. Now, the evening of July 15th, 1958, was a warm one in Woolton. Julia was visiting her sister Mimi and her husband George on Menlove Avenue. John, then 17, was waiting for Julia at her place in Springwood. A policeman knocked on the door and delivered the shattering news to John and Dykens.
She got killed by a off-duty cop who was drunk after visiting my auntie's house where I lived, but I wasn't there at the time. And so that was another big trauma for me.
Thank you.
And of course it was a terrible blow. That day was dreadful when she was killed. You know, I saw him the next day and there was just nothing to say, you know. I mean, his pain was obvious. But it was just a matter of saying, you know, I just said to him, I'm sorry about your mum, John, you know. And he just, like, shrugged and said, that's okay. But, you know, there wasn't anything more to say. There was nothing more. It was something that just had to be allowed to go. But it made a big, there was a big impact on him.
But I never left you.
So I lost her twice.
Yeah.
Once as a five-year-old, where I was moved in with my auntie, and once again, where she actually physically died.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very traumatic for me. I was at art school.
Which was turning out to be something that he hated. It wasn't anything to do with what, like the development of his artistic talents as he thought it would be. He used to say to me, Pete, it's dreadful, it's like maths at school. He said, I spend most of the time measuring out letters on pages and things like that. You know, there's no artistic freedom in the place at all. And so he was having a bad time like that. He was short of money as well. He was hitting the, you know, the skids kind of thing at that time. It all came together. It was the worst time of his life, and, you know, his mother getting killed was just like the thing that topped it. And he started drinking a lot during that time.
That was really a hard time for me, and it just absolutely made me very, very bitter. And
Yeah. The
underlying chip on my shoulder that I had as a youth was really big then. Being a teenager and rock and roll and sideboards and art school and mother being killed just when I was re-establishing a relationship with her.
It was a very bad period for him. In fact, I remember finding him on a bus one night, and I was coming home late, and he was laying on the back seat of the bus upstairs, you know, just like out of his head, unconscious. And he'd been on this bus for like 2 hours, you know, and backwards and forwards to the terminal, backwards and forwards, and I just kind of carried him off the bus and carried him over to Mendip's and got him up to bed and put him in. You know, it was a bad time for him, but you see, he never allowed anybody to see it. He always fought. I never remember him complaining or moaning about anything in his life. He always took it like a man, folks. You know what I mean, right? He was that type. He was strong. He wouldn't show any weakness if he could help it. But he came through with incredible strength, as he always did.
Some very personal and honest words from John's friend Pete Shotten. I want to thank Pete for sharing his insights with us. I hope you've enjoyed the show and have a deeper understanding of how John came to be the man he was. I look forward to being with you next time for The Lost Lennon Tapes. I'm Elliot Mins.
The Lost Lennon Tapes, brought to you by Listerine and by Nestle's Alpine White, sweet creams you can't resist. The Lost Lennon Tapes, a presentation of the Westwood One Radio Network in cooperation with the John Lennon Estate. Written and produced by Stephen Peoples. Production and engineering by Dave Kephart, with pre-production assistance by Michael Waters, Ray Klein, Jeff Kowalczyk, and Brian Schiff. Production coordinator, Steve Longo. Research consultant, Mark Lewison, with assistance from John Schwartz. Special thanks to
Dr. Demento.
Our executive producer, Norm Pattis. For Westwood One, I'm Scott Muni. Thanks for listening.